Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls One Planet series. In recent weeks, we have seen many reports about the dire impacts the COVID pandemic is having on the U.S. food supply. Millions of pounds of fresh vegetables are being thrown away or left to rot, and dairies are dumping milk as families turn to food banks to get by. Farm losses could reach $1.3 billion from March to May, according to the National Sustainable Agricultural Coalition. COVID-19 has exposed many problems facing the food system, including mega mergers and corporate consolidation. So what lessons can we learn from this crisis to mitigate what we're dealing with and also mitigate the impacts of the climate crisis on the food system from production to consumption? Today, we're joined by Georgina Gustin, reporter for Inside Climate News, where she covers climate change and agriculture. Hi, Georgina. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you back. We're also joined by Curtis Alexander, General Assignment Reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle, where he covers water, wildfire, climate, and the American West. Hi, Curtis. Thank you for joining us. Oh, I think we actually just lost Curtis, but we will bring him right back. Georgina, can we just start off by talking about, I just want to acknowledge the issues people are facing with hunger right now, given that we're talking about food. NPR had a really heartbreaking story this morning about how it's really difficult with for people with SNAP who have underlying health conditions because they cannot shop online. There is a pilot program in California, but it's rare. And they focused on a woman, Melissa Santos, and her wife. Melissa is a student at UC Berkeley, and she eats breakfast. She tries to get by with snacks. She suppresses her hunger with coffee, and then she has dinner. And I mean, she was almost crying when she was talking about this. So can you just start us off by just talking about how serious hunger is right now in the middle of this pandemic?
Yeah, it's a really serious problem, not just in the U.S., but globally. Hunger rates were going down for a number of years, and in the last couple of years, they've started to go up globally. So, and this is before COVID-19. And here in the U.S., you've seen food banks just completely overwhelmed as you have so many millions of unemployed, newly unemployed Americans. Hunger is a real thing for so many people. I think we're going to see more stories like the one you just referenced because this issue isn't going to go away quickly. And as more people lose their jobs and the disruptions to the, you know, farm economy continue, the UN's Food and Agriculture Organization projects that more people are going to go hungry globally, and that applies to the U.S. too. Mm.
Curtis, are you with us?
Yes, I'm here. Sorry about that.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Curtis. Can you also just talk about the crisis of hunger in the U.S. and around the globe? Anything to add there?
Sure. I think Georgina had kind of covered it, but certainly the food is not getting to where it needs to be. And right now, as she mentioned, we've had just record job losses over the past couple of months, so people don't have the income to go out and buy the food. You're also seeing some prices going up in certain sectors, so that makes it harder to access the food. And as Georgina said, this problem is only going to worsen as more people continue to lose their jobs and food banks just don't have enough food to support them.
Right. And it's important to note that, I mean, this is happening in, you know, poor parts of the country and very wealthy parts of the country. In a state like California, that's always considered the breadbasket of the world. I mean, people in the Bay Area are having a hard time buying enough food.
Yeah, California is definitely one of those places where we have a lot of rich people, but there are also a lot of people living in poverty. And during times like these, we see that disparity in wealth. And it is really sad when you see lines in front of food banks, when you have more people petitioning for food stamps and assistance programs. But that is happening right now. I mean, part of the reason we do have a lot of food, the food supply is not so much the problem. It's getting the food from point A to point B, and hopefully in the coming weeks and months, we can do a better job of getting the food where it needs to go.
In one of your latest pieces, Curtis, you write that the trucking business that carries agricultural goods to market has lagged as drivers remain at home because of the virus. You also report that air freight has slipped as international flights have been grounded, and many growers are starting to worry about farm worker shortages because of travel restrictions and border closings. We can talk about that later, but let's just first talk about transportation issues.
Sure. I mean, the truck industry has been suffering from a lack of drivers for some time now. They've had a hard time finding people to drive the trucks that move goods and food to market. So when the coronavirus hit, you had a lot more people staying home either because they were sick or they had family members who were sick or their children weren't going to school because the schools are closed and they needed to stay home with their kids. So even if there was food at a packing house or a processing plant that needed to be moved to a grocery store, you just didn't have the trucks available to move that food. And also, which I'm sure we'll talk more about, is there's been a real effort to move food to places where it typically hasn't gone, instead of going to wholesale markets, for example, getting it to retail markets like grocery stores, where we've seen an explosive demand. So having the trucks being able to reroute food to new supply chains has been increasingly difficult because of the lack of labor.
Right. And I think a lot of us are learning about how the supply chain works. Georgina, in one of your recent pieces, you write that most producers are set up to provide food for either the retail or the institutional side of the supply chain. So as restaurants and huge institutions, from universities to cruise lines to theme parks, have shut down and stopped buying the food, producers who supply them are either scrambling to find new markets or just dumping the products or plowing them under. So can you just tell us about this supply chain?
Yeah, so you described it, just as it is. I mean, if you're a food producer, you're set up to produce for the institutional side or the retail side, and they operate very differently. So if you're producing for the retail side, and that supply chain is kind of a rapid response supply chain, and they try to minimize waste in the system, and there's this whole sort of just-in-time concept that grocery stores or supermarkets operate under, where they restock, quickly. And so during this crisis, you've seen so many people, initially it looked like it was hoarding, but people were just going to grocery stores and buying a lot of food and wiping out grocery store shelves. And because of the way that supply chain is set up, it was difficult for supermarkets to restock quickly. And even now, you're still seeing some staples. The shelves are pretty thin. And also because people are just trying to minimize their visits to the grocery store, they're going once, a week or once every 2 weeks, and they're buying a lot of stuff, and so they're cleaning out the shelves. So those dynamics are at play on the retail side. And on the institutional side, generally the way that system works is you have, big volumes of food packaged together to get to an institution, to a school. And it sounds really kind of basic, but it's actually quite difficult to unbundle that stuff and distribute it in a way that makes sense for another supply chain, like the retail supply chain. So similarly, you have producers, you have producers producing for that supply chain, for the institutional supply chain, and they're not, those markets have dried up, and so they have no place to sell their produce, and so they're plowing it under, or in the case of milk, they're pouring it down the drain. And so that supply chain just isn't nimble enough to pivot to distributing that food in a different way. So it's just going to waste. And the USDA, actually, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, was pretty slow to respond to the crisis. And, it kind of got caught flat-footed. And so we're seeing this incredible, incredible waste at a time when hunger rates are going up. So it's just, grand and cruel irony.
So you say the USDA was slow to respond. What could the USDA have done about this?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I think they could have gone to producers, providing for the institutional supply chain, and tried to buy for government programs. Or they could have responded in such a way that they might have been able to get some of the food to food banks, although that's kind of tricky because in some cases, I heard of instances in Florida, for example, where the food banks were saying to producers, we can't take any more food, actually, or fresh food anyway, because obviously perishable food needs to be refrigerated and there's a lack of refrigeration in the system. So, I think the USDA could have bought some of this food faster and repurposed it, but they just didn't really apparently have their eye on the ball, and were slow to respond.
Wow. Curtis, what would you add based on what you've heard from people? What could the USDA have done?
Well, I think they could have done more earlier, as Georgina said. They didn't act until, say, mid-April when they passed a $19 billion aid program to try to address disruptions in the food supply chain. But we're seeing that now they are getting a little bit more direct relief to farmers so that they can plant their fields and try to get them whole. And they're also spending a little bit of money on trying to make sure the food that isn't spoiling does get to the food banks. Here in California, just last week, Governor Gavin Newsom announced a few million dollars to throw toward food banks, which are actually helping buy refrigerators and trucks to get some of that surplus food to the food banks and then be able to store it for longer periods of time.
And we'll talk about how the funding was distributed. But I want to ask you one more thing, Georgina, since you were talking about what's going on in grocery stores. I thought this was really interesting. Economists say that people in the United States typically eat 50% of their food away from home. So half of the meals are bought outside of the home. Under COVID, most of the meals are made at home. And so that's another reason why staples like dried beans, canned veggies, rice, things like that are hard to find. And I appreciate the point you make because we keep hearing about hoarding. But if you go to the store, once every 2 weeks, you're definitely going to buy more than normal.
Yes, for sure. That's a factor in this whole thing. There's that 50% that just shifted to supermarkets and to online retailers. It was impossible to find a bag of beans, in late March. Everybody's cooking and they're focused on cooking in a different way. People have a little more time on their hands. A lot of people are baking. We've seen story after story after story of, neighborhood groups sharing sourdough starters and flour being totally absent from grocery store shelves. So I think the way we eat has changed, the way we shop has changed, because we can't go to restaurants, we can't go to bars, our whole consumption pattern has changed completely.
That is Georgina Gustin, reporter for Inside Climate News, where she covers climate change and agriculture. Curtis Alexander is a general assignment reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle, where he covers water, wildfire, climate, and the American West. And on today's Your Call, we are talking about how the COVID pandemic is affecting the food system. Across the country, farmers are destroying tens of millions of pounds of fresh food, while millions of families are turning to food banks to get by. And I should say, if you are in California and you need assistance with food, we do have a resource page at kalw.org. There's lots of resources there, from food banks to community groups that are setting up food pantries, people who live alone. There are a lot of resources there. And if you have any questions or comments about the U.S. food supply, if you'd like to talk about your own experience, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. What has changed with you and your family's eating habits? What strikes you when you go shopping? And then if you have any questions about accessing food, we will try to answer those. And again, we have all of that on our resource page. Curtis, let's talk about some of the reporting that you've done on dairy. You write that the dairy industry, with its sprawling yet rigid distribution network, may be the hardest hit. So tell us what's happening with butter, cheese, and milk.
Sure. I mean, just to kind of piggyback on what we were talking about before, it seems like a no-brainer for supply chains to be able to pivot from wholesale institutional buyers to retail markets, to supermarkets, just move the food from one direction to the other, or send the trucks off from one point to another point instead of another point. But when I talked to dairy farmers, they really did explain how hard it is to move their product from one place to another. And starting with just cheese, a lot of the farmers in California, I think 40% of the milk goes to cheese, or a good bit of it does anyway. And a lot of this cheese goes to restaurants and schools and hotels and baseball stadiums and theaters and the larger venues. And that's probably why a lot of that food tastes so good. But that cheese is packaged in large, big crates and sent off to those buyers. So when you want to get that cheese to the people who need it now, you got to send it to the grocery stores, and the cheese has to be sliced from these large barrels into these small half ounce or pound containers. They have to come up with the packaging to put that cheese in, and being able to create the facilities to do all that can't be done overnight. They're trying to do that now as we speak, but it's just something that takes time.
So let's spend a little bit of time talking about what is being done about this. The issue of getting this food that would otherwise be wasted to people who desperately need it. I've read reports about, you know, some wealthy people bringing together their friends and colleagues to rent trucks to go pick up potatoes, for example, and then drive it across the country, or drive it across 5 or 10 states to get to a food bank or a food pantry. I mean, there's some wild things being done to tackle this. Georgina, what have you heard, and what needs to be done?
Well, I think what this is doing, this whole crisis, is really shining a light on our food system in this very immediate an unprecedented way. And so I think it's forcing a lot of people who think about food systems to contemplate how they should change to become more resilient, not just to an immediate shock like COVID, but to something more fundamental and longer lasting like climate change. I think a lot of what people are thinking about is how to make these systems more nimble. And one way, according to some people, is to shift away from a centralized, consolidated, sort of mega merger style food industry towards a more regionalized, food system, in which producers are growing a number of different things, and so if one thing, you know, falls apart or one thing fails, there are other redundancies in the system that will help them survive and will continue to provide food to people who need it. And I don't think we really know what the answer is, but I know there are a lot of advocates for that style of farming, that style of production, that kind of food system, who believe that what's happening now is really showing us that that type of system is going to be more resilient in the long run, and that's where we should focus our energies. And so that's kind of a kind of 30,000 foot sort of high level analysis, I guess. Not the specific example of people driving potatoes across the country, but I think that is one thing that is going to come out of this, is a sort of a renewed focus on what a resilient food system actually looks like.
Right. And of course, that's not sustainable, but it is what's happening to ensure that people get fed right now. Curtis, what would you add? First off, what are some short-term solutions? And then we can talk about long-term solutions.
Sure. I think one of the big problems is that food, unlike a lot of other products, is perishable. The thing with milk is you got to milk the cows every day. Right here in California now, we're having what's called the spring flush. The cows are at their most productive point of the year. They're producing all this milk. You can't just move. You got to move the milk quickly. You got to put it in refrigerators. It doesn't store long. And that's true of a lot of foods. They have a shelf life, or they can't be stored in warehouses or packing houses for very long. So part of the problem is being able to move them quickly to food banks or where the demand is. I think as far as long-term or at least short-term sustainability goes, shortening the supply chain is what people are trying to do. And there's a lot of sort of hiccups in the food distribution network right now. So the closer you are to your food source, the easier the problem is going to be to get rid of. I think we've seen a lot of smaller farmers anyway try to have more direct sales to consumers. I know that I've been to some farmers markets in California that have remained open. They seem to be doing a really good business. People want to go there instead of the grocery stores where they're having to wait in lines and not finding a lot of products. You're seeing the community supported agricultural boxes, a huge demand for those. A lot of those small farmers that sell those boxes of locally grown vegetables and fruits are getting to more people. And I've even seen websites for farmers in California that are saying, hey, we're selling X or Y product. Come over to the farm and buy it directly from us. So I think that is helping eliminate a lot of the waste that we'd otherwise see.
Right. We have heard reports about these boxes really selling in large numbers. That the problem is, and I'm thinking about people who are struggling, people on CalFresh. That's really inaccessible to people because those boxes tend to be, you know, $40, $50 minimum.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's definitely the niche markets that are doing better. Most of our country is fed through this. These larger farms that have these longer supply chains. So they definitely, it's definitely the people who don't have access to these higher end markets and these niche products that are going to be the ones feeling the pain.
Right. Oh, we have an email from Sandy who says the huge problem is with our food system being dependent upon agribusiness. Well, Sandy, after a break, we'll continue talking about the problem of mega mergers and corporate consolidation with our guests, Georgina Gustin, a reporter with Inside Climate News, and Curtis Alexander, a general assignment reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle. And today we are talking about the U.S. food supply and why are we seeing so much food waste when so many people are in need of food? What explains this? What needs to change in the short term to ensure that people get access to food as soon as possible? And then we'll also talk about long-term changes. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will hear from janitors on the front lines of the COVID pandemic. They say they still do not have PPE, and now they are using very heavy chemicals. Later in the show, we'll get an update on the COVID crisis in meatpacking plants. And if you missed any of our shows last week, we talked about lessons from the Deepwater Horizon disaster. We talked about testing, the U.S. economy, how COVID is affecting Indian countries. country. We also talked about what's happening in Brazil and the COVID crisis on cruise ships. You can find those shows at yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about how the COVID pandemic is affecting the U.S. food supply, what needs to change to ensure that people get the food that they need, and then what are some long-term changes to address these problems. We're joined today by Georgina Gustin, reporter with Inside Climate News, and Curtis Alexander, general assignment reporter with the San Francisco Chronicle. And let's hear from Bill in San Francisco. Hi, Bill. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I don't milk cows every day because I don't have any. A well-run and progressive administration would see this as an opportunity not only to meet the needs of the people in this country, but also in terms of foreign policy, in terms of, I mean, hunger around the world has gotten worse. There are ways that the government can do price supports, especially during emergencies. And it's beyond this administration's interest and capability, meaning the Trump administration, to do this. And it's shameful, because it could help the farmers, so that they could get their product to market. But it's clearly not the interest of the administration, unless it's like big agribusiness.
Well, Bill, as our guest said, the USDA failed to really address this issue at all. And in Georgina's piece, one of her pieces, she points out that in late March, the Trump administration resumed the process of allowing expedited mega mergers. And Georgina, Amanda Starbuck, a senior food researcher with Food and Water Watch, said her worry is that with small farmers and businesses going under because of the economic strain, bigger players could potentially buy them out.
Yeah, so there was the relaxing of that rule, which kind of went unnoticed. And that's just the latest in a long, decades-long trend toward mega mergers and consolidation and concentration in the industry. And recently, the Trump administration has, over the last couple of years, given something like on the order of $28 billion in relief to American farmers because of Trump's trade war with China, and to compensate farmers for losses related to that trade war. And essentially, that money has gone toward the big players. And so the money in terms of the aid money in this case, but subsidies or insurance subsidies, the system is really geared and has been for a long time towards supporting those larger agricultural players. And so to the caller's point, the trend really hasn't changed. And recently, as part of the CARES relief package related to COVID, there's the Paycheck Protection Program and the Economic Injury Disaster Loan Program, and those are supposed to get money to farmers, and apparently they're not, to the degree that farmers would like anyway. And also there's $19 billion dedicated to identified for farmers. And just last week, a group of 20 or so senators wrote to the USDA and said, please make sure this gets to the little guys. Because so far that has not happened. When any of this trade money in the last couple of the trade aid in the last couple of years, or much of it anyway, and they're worried that that's going to happen with COVID-related relief too.
Curtis, what would you add?
I would just add that it's always been the case where big farms have better lawyers, they have better lobbyists, and they've been able to get the money that's come out of Washington for agriculture. So they have benefited from trade relief programs and farm subsidies. In the latest CARES package, in the $19 billion relief plan, they did try to accommodate small farmers by having limits on how much money individual farms could get. I think the individual limit per farm was $250,000, which a lot of farms did not like, a lot of the big farms didn't like, because they're seeing losses that far exceed that. So they were angry about these relief programs as well. But at the same time, a lot of the small farms just don't know how to get this money or don't have people helping them get this money. So they haven't been able to benefit from the trade relief and the COVID-19 subsidies.
So they're dealing with exactly what small businesses are dealing with. Last night on 60 Minutes, they ran a piece called Why Are Hundreds of People in Big Cities Receiving Bailout Money Meant for Farmers? 60 Minutes reports that most of the money has gone to the biggest farms, one third of it, to just 4% of the farms. They report that most of the money has bypassed the country's traditional small and medium-sized farms that were battered by the loss of their export market, which is now being hit with severe losses from the pandemic. And in this piece, one of the farmers, and let me just grab his title, Bob Kulin oversees farmers in North and South Dakota. He says that they're going to see reports of suicide going up among farmers. Curtis, can you comment on that?
I haven't seen those reports, but I know that there is a crisis in farm country as far as not people just not making the money that they used to make. It's a hard business. And as you mentioned, a lot of the small farmers just aren't getting the money that these aid programs are giving out right now.
Anything to add there, Georgina?
Yeah, the farm economy has been in tatters for a few years now, and you have a situation where there's a trade war with China that's really hurt the farm economy. You've had a series of weather-related disasters, low commodity prices. Farmers generally are hurting, the billions in aid notwithstanding, because those are mostly going to the big guys. But the farm economy generally is suffering, and the small to medium farmers, as they have for decades now, they're the ones who are really feeling the personal pain of this. Mm-hmm. And there have been lots of reports across the Midwest, especially, of suicide hotlines getting a lot more calls, suicide rates going up. And, you know, these are difficult to disentangle, and I haven't reported on them directly, but I've certainly seen reports that's the case. And you can only surmise that this is just going to make things worse. And as you mentioned, with the economic hardship that comes with COVID or is coming with COVID, the bigger guys are going to be emboldened. The smaller guys are going to be, I'm being genderist here. I shouldn't be saying guys. They're women farmers too. But they're going to be pushed out of business, and the big are just going to get bigger.
Today we're speaking about the U.S. food supply and what we are learning with the COVID pandemic, given that so much food is being destroyed as demand is reaching new highs. And today we're joined by Georgina Gustin, reporter for Inside Climate News. Curtis Alexander is a general assignment reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle. You can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. We have an email from Bill, again, talking about the Trump administration. He writes, the absolute failure of the administration to maximize the food supply in this country is yet another major effect of Trump and company. I've got to believe that outside of well-organized areas like SF, San Francisco, and areas where mutual aid is more of a way of life so that Americans are in food security, here we have the food bank, Meals on Wheels, Project Open Hand. I've seen videos of cars in mile-long lines to get food at distribution. Yep, that is true, Bill. Thank you for the email. Let's also talk about globalization. Georgina, in one of your recent pieces, about the possibility of relocating a lot of this food production from California to the Mississippi Delta. You write that over the last 30 or 40 years, global agriculture has instead moved toward a system that critics say has become too large and focused on economies of scale. So talk a little bit about what we've seen with the changes in global agriculture.
You have regions that are becoming very specialized in doing one or two things. Russia grows wheat. We grow corn and soybeans. Brazil grows corn and soybeans. And when you have that kind of specialization and broad monoculture, you lose resiliency in the system because you're only producing one thing, and diversity of crops might be less efficient, but it's also more resilient, according to a lot of ag economists and rural sociologists who study these things, and. So if you have that kind of specialization and you know, global food trade and these long supply chains, as I've mentioned before, if something goes wrong, then you have a huge system or a bottleneck in a huge system that brings it down more readily. It's just not as... It's not as crisis-proof as smaller systems. The argument that's one argument goes. There are people out there who would say, well, we need both types of systems, big and small, and specialized and diversified to be truly resilient and to be able to feed the projected 10 billion people on the planet in 2050. Our food system is increasingly globalized. We depend on other countries for so much of what we eat, and other countries depend on us.
Right. And we've done shows on this, Curtis, because so many people, especially in the U.S., demand certain produce throughout the entire year. We are seeing a lot more fruits and vegetables brought in from other countries.
Sure, we are. And I think that's kind of one of the benefits, if you want to call it, of having a large globalized food system, is we can move things all over the world very quickly. If we want bananas year-round, or we want something year-round that doesn't grow in the U.S., we can get it. And we can move products even in our country overnight or even within the same day from one place to another, so we can really fulfill our demand for food. I guess the other benefit would be cost. We can produce certain things in places where they grow more efficiently and at less cost. California is great because of the weather, and we have the water system to grow a lot of vegetables and fruits and nuts and then move them all around the world. But as we've been talking about today, when you have a disruption in the food network, in the distribution system, that does reveal the flaws of having these larger supply chains. I think getting to a place where we also can get local food moving to areas where there's demand at the same time that we have these larger supply chains would be a very good idea. Right now, a lot of local food is sort of part of a niche market. It's often goes for a higher price, and sometimes it's because it can cost more to make the food locally. But there can be a place where there can be efficiencies in moving local food to local stores and not making it something that prices out people, because it does cost more to do.
Well, if you'd like to join us to talk about the U.S. food supply, how COVID has changed maybe your habits, what you're seeing in the grocery stores, we're talking about short-term solutions and long-term solutions, you can join us at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Let's talk a little bit about the workers in the United States, the very low-wage workers, either the farm workers, the meat processing workers. Georgina, I feel like because of COVID, I mean, there are more stories, especially about meat processing workers than I can remember, because they're getting sick. Sadly, some are dying. They still don't have PPE. Can you talk about the importance of this workforce?
It's critical to our food production in this country, and those people are they're absolutely essential to our food supply, and we treat them very badly, to put it simply, and generally speaking, but that is being revealed in you know, very vivid ways right now. You have the situation in, I think it's dozens now, of meat processing facilities where workers have to work right next to each other, and they don't have any PPE, and they go home at night and they sleep in dorms together, and they're incredibly vulnerable. That's why you see meat processing facilities that are coronavirus hotspots. And you have workers in the fields in California who are working in very difficult situations on top of each other, and they don't have a choice. They're absolutely essential, and we're seeing now all over the world where some of these travel restrictions are in place that these workers can't get from A to B. And that's part of why we're seeing such a, you know, disruption in supply chains, is because these workers can't get to the work. And in some cases, when they get to the work, they're getting sick and dying in really unacceptable numbers.
And in the case of the meat packing plants, Curtis, I mean, this is across the board for undocumented farm workers and meat plant workers. They lack health insurance. They don't qualify for unemployment insurance. They do not qualify for federal COVID relief. Governor Newsom said that undocumented immigrants will receive $500, but I mean, that's not enough to pay rent even for 1 month. These workers are in very vulnerable positions. Now we're actually seeing the children of these workers protest. Some were in Crete, Nebraska over the weekend. A few children were on a call today with Joe Biden, who says that he supports $13 an hour additional on top of their wages. And Curtis, as a result of these meat processing workers getting sick, we're now hearing that these slaughterhouses are going to euthanize tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of animals.
Yeah, I've heard reports of hogs and poultry and other meat that is surplus, and there's nothing the farmers can do with them when they have more coming in and they have none going out. On your point about relief for some of these undocumented immigrant farm workers, there was a push to get some of the money that was earmarked for farmers for aid to go to the farm worker pool to help get protection, to give them a little bit of extra money, to put in place some sort of regulation to make sure that they were staying safe during the pandemic. But none of that actually happened, so none of the money did go to extra protection. Here in California, I have seen farmers, the owners of the farms, voluntarily bring in more washing stations, hand sanitizers, change the number of people that are picking strawberries, for instance, from 30 people to 10 people, spread out the farmers in the fields and take greater precautions. But in places like packing houses and processing plants, like in the meat processing plants, it's often hard to avoid the workers not being in those very tight spaces where they're working hand in hand.
Just quickly, Curtis, what happened with that money that was supposed to go to the farmers? Why didn't it end up in the final, was it a bill? Is that what you're talking about?
Oh,
the farm workers.
Yeah, I think there was just a push to get farm workers some of the money that was in the relief fund to make sure that the farmers gave it to the farm workers, or in some way were using some of the money to spend to keep the farm workers safe. But from what I understand, there were no terms or there were no mandates to make sure the money was spent in that way.
Georgina, do you want to jump in there?
Yeah, I was just going to, two points. One is that, just to kind of add to what Curtis was saying, farm workers already are so vulnerable. They have a life expectancy of only 49 years. They're prone to illnesses, asthma, bronchitis. And so you layer a situation like COVID-19 on top of an already vulnerable population, and you get the numbers that we're seeing. So I was just going to add that in there. Also, the second point on the relief package, I think people generally, you know, agriculture groups were happy with the amount that Congress came up with, but they were disappointed with the lack of specificity around the money and who it should go to, how it would get there. And so I think there was some intention that it would get to farm workers, but how and how much, I think is a little bit up in the air.
Well, we did a show with Ann Lopez, executive director of the Center for Farm Worker Families, about farm workers on the central coast of California. She says that they work very long days. It's backbreaking work. And she doesn't know one person who makes more than $20,000 a year. And you can find that show at yourcallradio.org. Let's hear from a caller. Let's go to Jackie in Santa Cruz. Hi, Jackie. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you. There was another thing in the show last night on 60 Minutes. We could direct our congressmen and senators to make sure that this loophole that directs that money, the aid money, the $28 billion, and now the new batch for the COVID, goes to the small farmers. Because the way it's written now, there's a lawyer in Georgia that was working with people in like 25 states, big conglomerates, helping them get their sisters, their brothers, their cousins, anyone, all listed so that they all get the top limit. So if the restrictions say that are changed so that money can only go to the top limit, you know, for one entity rather than all these different people within an entity, then it'll get down, filtered down to the small farmers. But as it is, it all gets sucked up by these great big conglomerate farmers, and it's not good for us for all the reasons that you've mentioned.
Yeah, well, thank you, Jackie. And that piece ran on 60 Minutes last night, if anyone's interested in watching it. Curtis, are any California politicians on this? Are they talking about this?
You see a lot of the politicians in some of the rural areas of the state wanting more money, both for farmers and to fix the disruptions we've recently seen in the food supply. But then again, you got to remember that a lot of the financing that these politicians get, especially in California's farm country, does come from the big farmers. So a lot of the big farmers are happy with the status quo, and the little farmers don't always have the pull or the financing to sort of push what they want.
Well, we'll definitely do a show about this and bring on some small farmers. We only have 2 minutes left. We're going to have to do another show about this. But Curtis, you wrote a very important piece about California and the rest of the West sinking into a rare mega drought. Can you briefly tell us about this study? It's from scientists from Columbia, the University of Colorado, and the University of Idaho.
Sure. As most of us who live in California know, we suffered a really bad drought from about 2011, 2012 to 2016, 2017, 5 years of really dry winters. Most of our rain and precipitation comes in the wintertime, and we had five back-to-back dry winters. What these scientists were saying that is that this five-year period is actually part of a longer, perhaps decades-long dry period. Sure, we might have a wet year to break up these large chunks of dry years, but what we're seeing now is a dry period that rivals some of the longer decade-long dry stretches that we've seen over the past 1,400 years. So even when we have a wet year, that's not necessarily going to replenish our water supplies. The following year could be dry, and we do have a water system that can store water and serve up water for a couple years and help us withstand a few dry years. But if we have these things they're calling mega droughts, it's going to be that much tougher to get water to not only farms but to cities as well.
Mm. And final thoughts from you, Georgina, on the climate crisis and the food supply. You've done a lot of reporting on this.
Yeah, we've seen so much research over the last 10, 15 years. Of course, research going, starting 40 years ago began to project that climate change was going to have an impact on our agricultural systems. And that has only kind of accumulated to a greater degree. And especially in the last few years, we've had major international reports from the UN saying that climate change poses an existential threat to the way we feed ourselves. And so when you have a crisis like COVID, which is so immediate and kind of direct, I think it gets people really thinking about this broader problem and broader challenge that we face. And I think the lessons coming out of the COVID-19 crisis will be things that we can apply to our food systems broadly and hopefully
sorry to cut you off, but we are out of time, and we will definitely do a show about that and keep covering these issues. Georgina Gustin is a reporter for Inside Climate News. Curtis Alexander is a reporter with The Chronicle. Thank you both so much for joining us, and thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.